Welcome to the NJ Criminal Podcast and part two in this series.
Well, that leads us to the tan Mustang and the gun. Yeah. There was at least a witness or witnesses who indicated they saw a tan Mustang parked, I think it was behind Susan's blue convertible.
That's exactly right. So three boys from Folsom, Pennsylvania, outside of Philadelphia, driving north home from Wildwood, very drunk. Decided to pull over the road at about 4:30. They go to sleep and they wake up and they see the convertible, Susan's car there. There we go. There's the dog. So they drive north and they see, they don't drive north. They're parked and they go to sleep or pass out, however you want to characterize it. And they wake up and they say, 7:30, whatever, however long they slept, a couple hours, and they see the car there. And they're out of gas. The car was about 50 yards in front of them, this being Susan's convertible. They go past the car in search of a ride to get gas for their own car, go to Weiss's Esso station near the mall, off, I guess it's exit 36, come back and fill their car up and leave. They left one guy alone at their own car, and they said, they all passed lie detector tests, that none of them heard anything during the time when they were parked there, and the girl's car just appeared, which has always been probably the single most fascinating and mysterious aspect of this case to me, as to how three boys could sleep through being brutally murdered 50 yards or so from them, not hear any screaming, not hear a thing. That's what originally, just to me, is one of the most amazing aspects. The second thing regarding that particular set of circumstances, which has always fascinated me, is how a person, whoever this murderer or murderers were, was, sees this tan Mustang over these two girls, murders them, gets in her own car, leaves. Why would you this sort of crime when you know you had witnesses nearby who could do this in any second?
Yeah, it doesn't. That doesn't make sense that the murderer would have directed either Susan or Elizabeth to pull over that spot.
Right.
Now, were those individuals ever publicly identified?
They were not. I learned their identities a couple of years ago. Maybe it was right before the publication of the Garden State Parkway murders. I learned of their identities through an anonymous source. I then contacted them. All three of them, interestingly enough, still reside in Folsom area, which is a very small town. Mm-hmm. And I learned their names, and one of the gentlemen I left a couple messages for, he never returned my call, which is interesting, is that I think I had called on one of my second calls or whatnot. I called the same person up after having left a message saying, I'm writing a book, I'd like to talk to you, blah, 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 blah. And a woman answers the phone and says, oh yeah, hey, what did they do down there anyway? This is Christian Barth. I'm the writer. She goes, oh, I'm going to give you a call back. So she had just immediately, sort of referencing me, ironically, when speaking with me at the same time.
Not realizing else, who so, you were, right?
Exactly. So I don't know why this person never returned my call. I just wanted to get some, maybe, his take, his perspective on what happened, as opposed to what I'd read in the paper. But he never did return my call. And am I suspicious of that? And I'm not overly. I think people just, are worried they're going to be associated with a brutal murder. Maybe that's why. I really, frankly, don't know why he didn't, or neither his friends did neither. But it was a similar reaction to the two other kids that were with the first gentleman, Mr. McMonagle, that met the girls at the diner. I told him I wanted to speak with them, and he knew who they were, and they were both living, and they didn't want to speak with me either.
All right. Next thing they know, they're getting a request for DNA.
Yeah, right.
So there were a number of suspects, and there were, this was a obviously a huge investigation, boots on the ground, but it was, you know, real detective work. This was, you know, before DNA, before cell phones were used to track people, before, you know, video surveillance. And so they, it does appear that there were a number of different angles that the state police worked, which led them to, I mean, you describe in great detail, Mark Thomas, Gerald, is it Stano or Stano?
It's Stano.
Ronnie Walden, and then obviously Ted Bundy. So, you know, describe for us just kind of generally the links to each of these individuals, and you know, no one has been arrested. Obviously, the investigation is still open. But you've basically done quite a bit of your own investigative work. And again, this is all said with the caveat that we don't know what's in any files because you haven't been able to review police reports. So I'm just kind of curious, and we could probably talk about this all day, but if you could just describe for our listeners what steps in the days, weeks, months, years following these murders did state police and other investigators take, and where did it lead them?
Well, there was obviously front page stories in the Inquirer, all the local newspapers, UPI picked it up, APL, all the wire services all over the country that these girls were found, splashed all over the Atlantic City Press. So there was a news conference at which time Brennan gave a hotline for people to call. And what happened was, as a direct result of that, a couple days, I think it was, I want to get my date straight, June 4th, maybe June 5th, it was a Thursday, I want to say, Meg, over in Philadelphia, on 13th Street, at a clothing store, the guy who owned the store was a gentleman, and I've learned this since the publication of the book, named Al Tendler. On Tendler's clothing shop. And Mr. Tendler overheard this kid saying that he was in Ocean City at the time of the murders. He contacted the Philadelphia Police Department, who dispatched homicide detectives to pick up this kid whose name, as we learned, was Mark Thomas, the local boy from Norristown, sort of a hippie.
Was he wearing a yellow turtleneck? Is that...
He was wearing, that was the irony of it all, is that he was wearing a yellow shirt, and it was that yellow shirt, in addition to the remarks he had made cryptically, that prompted this store owner to contact the police, and that, of course, which Al Hickey said he saw the person at the Circle wearing someone in a yellow shirt. I always felt that was ironic that Hickey later would change his story as to what he remembered the person wearing, but based upon sort of his circumspect recollection, we find a person who winds up being a prime suspect. So what happened with Mark was they brought him into the police department, and the Philadelphia Police Department began to question him intensively, and being an attorney, you know, that sort of blurred line between custody, non-custodial interrogation, and whatnot from criminal procedure, but they questioned him, and
he was in custody, I think.
So too, yeah. And they offered him, you know, they said, "You want to take a lie detector test?" And he did, and didn't perform well. They characterized as fuzzy answers to crucial questions. In light of satisfaction with the test results given by the Philadelphia Homicide Department, is it polygrapher? Am I pronouncing that correctly?
Yeah.
They contacted New Jersey State Police over, and Lieutenant Brennan in charge of the investigation contacted George Dix at his home in South Jersey and said, "George, you've got to get over there to Philadelphia, and you need to talk and see if this guy will, you know, get on the box," which is parlance for the polygraph exam. So he went over there with Harvey Burns and James Patterson, interestingly enough, they took police captain Carpani's, John Carpani's cruiser to go over there. And it was right around the time, according to George Dix, that they were coincidentally interviewing or putting on the box the three kids who were in the tan Mustang. So they went over to Philadelphia and question mark all throughout the night and didn't give them another lie detector test, because apparently you really have to be fresh and focused in order for there to be a good reading on the test. And they felt that he had been in custody or not in custody for so long that they weren't going to accomplish that. So there was a hold, an 18-hour or 24-hour hold, whatever it was, law in Pennsylvania, that if you didn't charge a suspect within a certain amount of time, you had to leave and let him go. So they wound up letting him go. And George Dix and James Patterson, both of whom passed, both said that they had real heated discussions with one another as to what to do with Mark after he, left, or after he was freed, so to speak, from the homicide department. And it was just so strangely ironic that Mark agreed to accompany them to New Jersey for more questioning. He just said he needed to sleep. So they drove him over the bridge. And right before they get over the bridge, they find out, this being the three detectives and Mark Thomas, that they don't have the money to go over the toll. So Mark offers 50 cents driving, when they all look at one another like, wait a second, no, 50 cents. Why is this kid who's free to go agree to accompany us and give us 50 cents to go and come more questioning? Makes no sense whatsoever. So they go over to the Berlin barracks. It's now some sort of police operational facility. It's still there. Last time I checked, it's not even there. There's not a circle there either. That's gone. Was it the old Berlin circle? Mm-hmm. And they interviewed him for a time until before they interviewed him, I'll take it back. They decided he wasn't going to give a good read. So they took him to a hotel in Berlin called the White Way Hotel, allowed him to sleep, and then drove him back to the barracks. And at that point, word had gotten out that they had a suspect, and his parents showed up with attorney Edward Kane, who demanded that they either charge or release Mark, and they did so. So that was what happened with Mark Thomas. He indicated that he was just shooting his mouth off. He didn't know the girls. And they never had anything to tie into the crime, but he was the first main suspect, again, ironically discovered because of the yellow turtleneck, as described by Al Hickey.
You, as you were conducting your investigation, I thought this was very interesting. You actually received a correspondence, a fax or a phone call from a woman who indicated that, she believed that she knew who murdered the girls and that she had been trying to, quote unquote, get the New Jersey State Police to listen to her. And then that was ultimately Ronnie Walden, because of the watch. So was that, I know that was not something that was really publicly discussed, but talk to me about how you spoke with her and what she told you.
Well, in viewing the material, the reports and whatnot, and my conversations with people, Ronnie Walden was listed as a person that the police had spoken with, but none of the detectives I'd spoken with even referenced him.
Which I thought was odd.
So, yeah, it was very, very odd. And I'm sitting here in my office, and this was, at some point this person learned that I was writing the fictionalized version and investigating the case at that time. And it was in 2006. And I remember that I got a fax at work and they said, this came for you. And it wasn't attached to file number. I'm like, okay. And it read it. It was handwriting. It was a fax cover sheet. I understand you are researching this case. It's my opinion that the person who killed those girls is Thomas Ronald Walden from Cairo, Georgia. And that's that. You want to call me? So I spoke with her. Extremely credible. We've really continued a line of conversation and a friendship years and years later. So what she relayed to me was this. She said that Ronnie went by his middle name, She met Ronnie along with a couple of friends of hers when they were down in Fort Lauderdale for spring break in the spring of 69, which would have been, what, March, probably. And he had taken a liking to one of Kathy was her name, one of Kathy's friends. They invited Kathy, her sister, and this other girl, the three of them, to have dinner at her place, at their place. The guys, they're renting a place, Ronnie's bachelor pad, rental house, whatever, nearby. They went the next night. And she said that he sat next to her at dinner and paid a sort of almost an unusual fascination with her hair. She had this blonde, you know, long hair, and that was strange, but it, you know, it was the 60s. So a lot of stuff happened then that wouldn't fly right now.
If you're interested in starting a podcast, visit the contact page at njcriminalpodcast.com and send Meg a message. She'd love to discuss your legal podcast, and her producer has experience with podcast launches for businesses of all types. Don't hesitate to reach out and see if podcasting is a good fit for you.
So he said, and she noticed that his watch was nice. It was on one of those, they called them mod bands back then. It was a thick leather band for the watch that people would customize with artwork and whatnot. And the face itself was in that watch. And the watch is it's called a Belfort Sea Diver watch, manufactured by Benroos Company in Ridgefield, Connecticut. And it said on there 17 jewels. And she thought it was interesting. Why would a watch say, you know, 17 jewels? And he showed it for her, showed it to her. And it was sometime after that that he had just sort of an apoplectic fit for no reason. Her sister had spilled wine, and he went to this rage, the sudden rage that she just couldn't forget. And when she went home for spring break, she obviously was sitting at her desk, worked at the Social Security office in Atlantic City, and heard over the radio piping in that they had discovered the bodies of these girls. And they said that one of them had blonde hair, and that they had found a watch, or may have said dive watch at the time. And she immediately said, oh my God, I know who did this. And she contacted the police, went there, told them her story, and they kept pressing.
And just to be clear, he had come up to the area. She met him in Fort Lauderdale, but he had decided to come up.
Thank you for reminding me that. Yeah. There's another aspect of that to Ronnie. He had, in addition to her seeing at that time, a couple of weeks later, Ronnie shows up to the Social Security office to see Kathy's friend. And the friend was preoccupied, said, can you show Ronnie where to park? He said he was driving north, you know, on the way to New York or something like that.
In Atlantic City.
North Jersey, in Atlantic City. And comes up in a yellow souped-up car. And my friend Kathy goes out to show him where to park. And he trying to get into a spot. And he flips out again. And he's just going in because he just couldn't get out. And he slams the brakes, and a knife slides out from underneath the passenger seat. She sees that, and he just, oh, it's nothing. It's nothing. This is the second time now she's sort of thinking this guy's not 100% there. So Annette afterwards, of course, was when she had heard on the radio and put two and two together. So she goes to the police and recounts for them her encounters with Ronnie in the two separate instances. And they kept pressing her, well, was this guy wearing any jewelry? And she said no, because by that she had inferred, well, necklaces, chains. You sure he wasn't wearing any jewelry? She said no. And they said, well, was he wearing a watch? And she said, absolutely. And she said, they showed her a picture of the watch they found at the crime scene and said, well, is this the watch? And she accurately confirmed and said, no doubt about it, that's the watch he was wearing, because she saw the jewels, the 17 jewels on the face. So based upon that information, the New Jersey State Police did an NCIC search and learned that Walden was being held in custody in Glenwood Springs, Colorado jail. And they sent Jim Toth and one other investigator. It was Bill Hunter and Jim Toth out there to question Ronnie. And this is where the newspapers screwed up. And when my interview sort of, I fleshed out what really happened, and it was a crucial mistake on the newspaper's part. They had said that, you know, there was obviously the police went out there, and we'll get to the mistake in a second. So the police are going out there. Let's say it's a Wednesday afternoon, several hours before their arrival, and Ronnie was apprised that they're going to come. Ronnie tries to hang himself in this jail cell, which, as it turned out to be, the same jail cell that serial killer Ted Bundy escaped from years later before going on to kill the girls down at Florida State.
Such an odd coincidence.
Extraordinary coincidence. And I interviewed the jailer who told me this. Very, you know, and he's the one who brought that up, and it was fascinating to me. But the newspapers would report that he passed a lie detector test after this it all happened. But they said that, I'm going to get my facts straight here. The newspapers had written that he tried to kill himself after the lie detector test. What I learned was he tried to kill himself before the state police got there. So I had always thought, but then he passed the lie detector test. So I was always thought it's awfully strange. You know, was it guilt? Why did he try to kill himself? This is a guy who by this time was AWOL from the Air Force, was a seasoned car thief. Okay. He had been in and out of jail, you know, from the time of, you know, 18 forward for various reasons. I interviewed, everyone said he was sort of a definite sociopath, a glib
con man.
He would, you know, one example was a guy I interviewed said when he was in Colorado, he went in, he would go into a real estate office and say, hey, you know, I want to look at a property. And a guy would take him out the property and, you know, he'd hold the person up, or he would go into a property, steal stuff. He'd ingratiate himself with the good intentions of innocent people across America is what he would do. Steal in and out. So Ronnie, of course, because he passed a lie detector test, the police, I think they lost interest in him because of that, and also because he was already going to go to federal jail for there was already a warrant out on him by the time the New Jersey State Police became interested in for auto theft. He had stolen something after he left New Jersey and gone to Nashville, and then from there to Colorado. So I think because jail, society was going to do it, you know, like a 9-year stint before he got on probation, that the state police probably suspected, well, there's no point in focusing our interest on this guy.
But he ultimately murdered somebody, right?
He did. Mm-hmm. And then years go by, and Ronnie gets out and continues his life of crime. And in 1984, he was in South Carolina. And continuing his ruse of being interested in properties in, right around the Charleston area, he met a realtor, took him out, tried to rob him, and the realtor fought back, and Ronnie shot him in the head, killing him with a gun he had stolen in one of his travels. He then went to, you know, jail thereafter. And in 1989, again, coincidentally, not too far from when Ted Bundy was executed, Ronnie was in jail and smuggled a gun into jail and held a security guard, a guard, hostage for 24 hours. And then let him go, and Ronnie wound up killing himself. It's interesting when you were talking earlier about him, the police, there was such a disparity between what I was learning and what the New Jersey State Police knew about Ronnie, because the person I was speaking before, Kathy, who had given me the information and had met with him in Atlantic City, in Fort Lauderdale, she had sent me, faxed to me, the notes commensurate with her conversation with the police. They had asked her, well, show us, you know, tell us, you know, what his house was like in Fort Lauderdale. And she had a list of things. And she was told at the time that the New Jersey State Police had found a fingerprint of Ronnie's on Susan Davis's car. And the reason she remembered it is, and written it down, is because the state police detective who told her this said that they were 99 and 44 100% sure that it was Ronnie Walden based upon that, but because it was a half a print, they couldn't do anything with it. But the 99 and 44 100 saying was, I guess, a trademark phrase used by Ivory Soap at the time in their commercials. Our soap is 99, mm-hmm. you know, whatever.
So she remembered it. That, it stood out to her.
Exactly. So she maintained these notes and sent them to me. But, you know, no one, and after I received these, I called several state police cold case detectives, and no one had heard of Ronnie Walden. And I was a little disturbed that one of the guys I spoke with said he didn't know where he was. And the time that I had spoken with this person, you know, Ronnie had been dead for several years. So, you know, I don't know how he wound up escaping, given the evidence against him. Hmm. Continuing with that, and completely independent of my conversations with that person, Kathy, I randomly one day, and this goes back to, you know, really you need to do dogged research. I literally looked on a Google map, saw the names of persons listed that were near the parkway, and stumbled upon a person who said, oh, yeah, I remember that case. And I actually met a guy from Georgia who picked her up. She was picked up on a date by this guy in a motorcycle, drove her around, and they went to a movie, and she said he pulled over to the side of the road near the FAA center down there and just stopped and looked at the woods, and she said, I'm going to die. She said, this is the point, I'm going to die. She thought she was going to get murdered. So, and it didn't happen, but that was another instance where Ronnie had, you know, met women down there. And during the time that he was here, he was actually working at a place in Atlantic City called a Man and a Woman Clothing Shop. And another, which lends itself to his possible culpability in this, is the watch that Kathy had said she'd seen him wearing. That, again, was kept quiet. And once it was in the Atlantic City Press, but it was also in the Inquirer, the Atlantic City Press, where they first mentioned, this is several days after the girls were found, that it was a dive watch. And the same afternoon in the Atlantic City Press, it was listed that it was a dive watch they had found near the crime scene. Ronnie steals money from his boss down there, steals a motorcycle, and leaves. So I just thought that timing was a little interesting as to why he left town immediately and went then to Nashville and then to Colorado.
And then there's some indication that at some point he had some interest in dive gear.
Yeah, I interviewed a man who, of course, Ronnie had stolen goods from down at a dive shop in Florida. And one of the things he was attempting to pawn was dive gear. He didn't recollect whether it was a watch. And Kathy had also mentioned when the police had requested her to, you know, recollect for them what his bachelor pad was like down there. She had mentioned she saw a wetsuit and some other things that suggest that, you know, this watch might have belonged to him.
Yeah, I'm curious if your book has spurred either interviews or follow-up interviews of any of these people that you've spoken with. But obviously, we won't know that, but I would imagine that it would have. Other than Mark Thomas, Ronnie Walden, you spend a significant amount of time in the book talking about Gerald Stano. Who was he, and why was he brought up as a suspect? And were there any other suspects that were looked at closely that you're aware of, either at the time of the murders or after?
Well, Gerald was an interesting guy. So Gerald's name arose in connection with the Parkway murders in 1980. He at the time had just been arrested for the murders of some women down in Florida in Daytona Beach area. There had been a series of unsolved killings with prostitutes, and a couple of college girls had disappeared as well. In the course of, you know, one of his attempts to murder a person, a survivor indicated that, you know, she identified him, and it wasn't very difficult because everyone said he was driving the same red car. And he started spilling the beans. He said, you know, oh, yeah, I killed these girls, and a detective down there named Paul Crow became interviewing him and interviewing this guy's confessing right and left. And this is where it got very interesting. This is one of those situations where I just found out a lot of information that otherwise detectives didn't know about, or the state police detectives in New Jersey. And I found just by research. And one of them was that at the time he started confessing to his murders in Florida, obviously he had divulged his background. And he was... He lived with his parents in the Norristown area, in the same town, Bluebell, as Mark Thomas. And they lived about a mile away. And I would find out years later that they did, in fact, know one another as teens. They're both had juvenile delinquency records. And no one had known of that connection before. I just happened to stumble upon it and discussing it with a Pennsylvania State Police detective. And when I was asking about Mark Thomas, and he said, oh, yeah, you know, he was friends with that serial killer, you know. I'm like, whoa. And I knew right away what he was talking about. And then I talked to him. I said, oh, yeah. And then I went and talked to another one with Whitpain. Whitpain Township was the local police department in that jurisdiction over Bluebell. And they were well aware of Mark because of his juvenile record, as well as Gerald. But what I learned was Gerald and Mark were, in fact, were acquaintances, and that Roger Stana, who was Gerald's younger brother, also juvenile delinquent, had, in fact, been with Mark at the Jersey Shore at the time the murders occurred, and that the state police had, in fact, were interested in Roger, who was only 16 at the time, not necessarily Gerald. Roger has since gone to his reward, but I thought that was absolutely fascinating. It caused me to think, well, maybe there was were a bunch of these kids that were down there. So Gerald signs a confession to the Garden State Parker murders in 1982, and by Paul Crow. And as a result of that, detectives Bob Mulholland and Tom Kinzer of the state police, both of whom are alive still, I believe, fly down to Florida and interview him. And they think there was nothing that suggested that this guy knew anything about the crimes. They were giving him the holdbacks, you know, the stuff that the police didn't divulge, and he was getting it all. They left completely unconvinced. They thought this guy was completely flawed.
They think he did it to garner favor on whatever he was facing.
That's exactly right. He was down there, and he was, you know, he had all these things. And they said, well, Florida, Daytona Beach detectives say, we want to keep you down here. So these guys up in Pennsylvania, New Jersey, don't come down here and get you. And Gerald wasn't the sharpest tool in the box. So he sort of was like, oh, okay. You know, so there was discussion afterwards Gerald wound up going to the gas chamber in Florida. Not the gas chamber, I'm sorry, the electric chair. But as far as the defense, you know, the defense team trying to keep him out of there always indicated that his confessions were coerced. But I talked to several detectives down there who said, no. He did it. But they couldn't, no one was able to, Meg, confirm that Gerald was interviewed in 1969 by the New Jersey State Police. The only thing sort of correlated to that was the confirmation from the Whitpain Township, Pennsylvania detective, who told me that it was Gerald they were interested, Gerald's younger brother, Roger, they were interested in, but nobody in the state police even confirmed that they had spoken with Roger or Gerald in 1969.
Yeah, I was going to say, just to be clear, so it's not as though Gerald was a suspect back in 69 or even during the 70s. It was only the only time he really came up as an individual or a suspect was when he supposedly confessed in 1982.
Right. Okay. 19, and I gathered from the Florida Department of Law Enforcement officers, Florida Department of Law Enforcement, I forget which agency it was, the sheriff's office maybe, I got Gerald's records and learned that in 1980, that was when he obviously was first arrested. There was, I think once the detectives down there in Daytona Beach found that he was from there, they began calling the jurisdiction to see if there's any connection to cases nationwide. And it was in 1980 that Crow had reached out to Lieutenant Toronto, the New Jersey State Police, and indicated, that they had Gerald and were there any other cases. And one of the cases which was brought up in the discussion was that of the Garden State Parkway murders, but the file indicated that the suspect was Mark Thomas, and there was no indication that they were friends based upon that report. But that's something I found that no one had until that point. So between 80 and 82, I guess, his arrest, and then for about a period of 2 years, he was doing a lot of confessing. And when he signed his confession to the Parkway murders in 82, he said it was 1973. He killed two college girls. So the time and place was off.
Thank you for listening in. Stay tuned for the next part in this conversation. This podcast is not a source of legal advice. No two legal cases are the same. Contact an attorney if you require legal assistance.